From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, January the 9th, 2020. And got a good full show for you today. We're going to be talking about sexual harassment, about the possibility of decriminalizing sex work in Vermont in the first hour of the program with two folks from the Vermont Commission on Women. We are pleased to say we have in the studio with us this morning the chair of that commission, Lisa Senecal, and the executive director, Carrie Brown, and they're going to be sharing with us what their thoughts are about some of the legislation percolating along that is of particular interest to women, especially. Now, I've got to say that all of this stuff, you know, slightly more than half the population, yes, but also many, many thinking men out there who realize that good stuff that's good for women is good for humanity in general. So we'll get to those kinds of things in a few minutes. First, I wanted to tell you what we have upcoming in our second hour. We have a couple folks from the UVM Extension Service who are going to be talking to us today about water quality in agriculture, a big issue percolating along, no pun intended, with lots of discussion in recent years, legislation in the legislature and so on, but really highlighted by a rather unfortunate situation that unfolded last week when the Attorney General announced a lawsuit against Vermont's largest dairy farm, saying that the folks up there had not been following the state permit rules, and we'll get into some of that in our discussion in the second hour of the program. I believe that sandwiched in between the two, we are going to have one of our national correspondents joining us this morning to talk about some what's going on in Washington. So lots coming up on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. But first, I wanted to get to the guests who are with me in the studio right now. No time like the present. And Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown of the Governor's of the Vermont Commission on Women. I knew I'd mess that up again because when I first heard of it, it used to be called the Governor's Commission. And I somehow that just stuck in my brain and has never left. I wish I could banish it, but it is the Vermont Commission on Women. And the I want to thank you two for joining me in the studio this morning.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you.
So there's lots going on. One thing that I sort of missed a couple of weeks ago, I want to get caught up on, was a study that came out from, I believe it was Vermont Works for Women, talking about how the role that women play in the economy and how they mesh into the workforce and so on. Carrie, maybe I'll start with you and ask you to sort of give us a recap. What was the news there?
Sure. Are you, the Change the Story report on mm-hmm. women work and wages? That's right. So Change the Story is a partnership of the Vermont Commission on Women, Vermont Works for Women, and the Vermont Women's Fund. And we've been around for a few years doing a lot of work focusing on women's economic security in Vermont. And one of the main activities we've had is research on women's economic well-being. And we recently released an updated report that is, it's pretty long. It's got a lot of information in it. It talks about how much money women are making, what kinds of jobs they're doing. We look at very deeply the wage gap and some of the reasons for that. So it really goes into a lot of depth, much more than our previous reports did. It also includes some data on women of color and on women with disabilities and on LGBTQ women. And so it really expands the work that we did before in our data research.
And I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, a lot of subchapters in this report, and let's just start with the wage gap, for instance, how does Vermont compare with the nation at large on that question, on the ratio of men's pay to women's pay?
Well, we are on the upper end when you look at states. Women in Vermont make about 84% of what men in Vermont make, which is higher than the national average, which is, I think, maybe 79% at this point. Mm-hmm. And so we're one of the highest in the country. We're not the highest, but we're up there. But it hasn't really changed in quite some time. So that's another thing that we're tracking is, are we making any progress? And we saw nationally, as well as in Vermont, a lot of progress in the 70s and the 80s, where women's wages really went dramatically up compared to men's, but it really kind of leveled off, and it hasn't changed for a number of years now.
Hmm. And there's been a big push on this, you know, nationally and internationally recently with the U.S. women's soccer team and soccer programs right down, including our local one up in Chittenden. In Burlington, it's gotten some national news with the girls' soccer club up there. With their T-shirts, they got a penalty for wearing these T-shirts, but you know, rah-rah for the First Amendment and for the issue they are expressing, which is pay equity, is an important thing. What did the report find were the stumbling blocks or the obstacles to pay equity, Lisa?
Well, there are quite a number of them, and it's one of the reasons that this is such a difficult problem to solve, and it's taking a lot of time to get there. Excuse me. So the issues that we're looking at are things like the types of work that women do, and that tends to be one of the things that people really focus on and make the assumption that, well, women choose to go into occupations where the pay is lower, and there is truth that women tend to be in lower paying jobs, but then you have to look deeper behind those numbers and figure out why it is that women are in those jobs. Some of it is tradition. Some of it is employment that tends to be much more heavily male, you tend to have more issues with sexual harassment. And so women end up moving away from those jobs. Some of it is the training that women tend to go into. Some of it is what they are sort of channeled into. As we go through school, women tend to start decreasing in numbers in STEM fields. And that's something that we really have to keep pushing, that these are not male fields. But unfortunately, one of the things we do know is that in STEM occupations, those are some of the worst offending fields for sexual harassment issues. So even women who do go into those fields and end up getting good positions, it has a high rate of women leaving those occupations because they face discrimination within them.
And it becomes a sort of self-reinforcing situation then, it sounds like, where, I mean, if it's tough for women to break into some of the STEM occupations and you show up at the workplace and you're in there with a bunch of dudes who are basically being pretty cavalier and callous about all matters of sexual harassment and so on, it can create a bad environment. And so, yeah, it's discouraging. And you end up, that's just one of the sort of almost evolutionary factors or whatever, where you would end up with fewer women in that workplace. And gee whiz, that workplace, those salaries tend to be high in the STEM fields. And so this shows up in the statistics. It's kind of weird how these things are kind of almost, these factors are almost seem to be sometimes built to support each other or something. So
it's true. You're talking about an entire system and this is part of why it's so complex to get at why it is that there's pay inequity. One of the things this report does is it talks specifically about the impact of sexual harassment, as well as on intimate partner violence and some other things that we haven't gotten into necessarily as much before. But that these are lots of things that can combine to make to create challenges for women that could otherwise block them from good paying opportunities.
Hey, folks, 244-1777 is the call-in number here. If you have any questions or comments you would like to put to the chair, Lisa Senecal of the Vermont Commission on Women, or Carrie Brown, the executive director, or both. They're both here this morning. You are more than welcome to join the discussion here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And, you know, I want to stay on this topic a little bit longer and more. Let's probe it a little more deeply. Because of pay inequity for women, one of the issues that I hear a lot in this connection is that if women are going to have children, there's a lot of just de facto pressure out there for them to step out of the workforce for some length of time, and that tends to basically pull them out of the whole promotion stream and so on in the workforce. You know, they're not in the office or they're not on the shop floor. And for some period of time, and they sort of, you know, get forgotten about the next time the round of promotions comes around. How big a factor is that? Do we find out in this study to pay inequity?
Yeah, there is. I'm going to rifle through my notes right here. But there, okay. This is one of the things that we actually tried to quantify if we could. I mean, it's just estimates. But when you look at women who are taking time out from the workforce, and I may not be able to find the statistic right here at the top at my fingertips, but that it's not just an impact immediately on my salary went down because I took 5 years off, but mm-hmm. it's over the course of a lifetime. So it's those opportunities for advancement, for promotion that are really particularly felt towards the end of one's career. So when it's getting to be time for retirement and Social Security is the draw is much lower. It's much lower for women than it is for men in Vermont. And that's because of a lifetime of earnings and savings for retirement. And these things all add up to quite a lot of money potentially for women over the course of their lifetime.
The other interesting thing here to me is the intergenerational impacts of this. I had Art Wolf on the show the other day, economist and former UVM economics professor, and I was asking him about this because this whole topic of Vermont not having enough workers right now, and we were talking about population decline and so on. And I said, well, our current economy makes it really, really hard for someone to decide, you know, I'm going to take a few years off and raise a child and then return to the workforce later or whatever. Should employers who have a long-term interest not only in basically having more people so they have more customers and more potential workers 20 years from now, you know, should they, can you imagine a corporation thinking that far out in the future? Or, you know, I know the pressure is always on to get the next quarterly results and so on. But, I mean, it's just there's this weird structure in our economy which seems to push against the whole idea of supporting families and families having kids so you have some workers and customers later on.
Yeah, there's that pressure. And then there's also the intergenerational pressure that falls most heavily on women again, where Vermont has an aging population and the gender that tends to most heavily bear the burden of caring for aging family members or sick family members happens to be women. So in addition to having the majority of the child care responsibilities still, we also have those responsibilities. And when you, when even a two-income household looks at what the expenses of having caregiving either for elderly family members or in childcare, and you look at what the salaries are of the two people in that couple, it's more likely that it is the male who is earning more money. And if one person is going to step away from work, it only makes financial sense for it to be the woman. Unfortunately, that means when she does want to re-enter later on, she's probably going to enter at a lower salary, and she has that break in her earnings during the time that she was home, which will carry through all the way into retirement, both in the money you set aside and Social Security.
Yep. Yeah.
And this is one of the areas where we talk about women's choices, and it gets kind of tricky because it's maybe families are making decisions, such as Lisa described, which don't necessarily feel like fully free choices to a lot of people. They feel like they're kind of backed into having to make these decisions that aren't necessarily in their long-term financial interest.
Yeah, or certainly they are under pressures that are not of their own making. Mm-hmm. That is really very clear there. I think that I still think the onus is ideally would be a little bit on employers out there. And I know business people always complain about the tax burdens and the regulatory burdens and the other burdens that society wants to place on them and so on. But just from a purely, if you have a long-term vision of your business success in the future, I really do think that you might say to a young woman who's considering stepping away to become a mom for a little while, this is actually the best contribution you can make, or we're going to really value this contribution right now because you're able to do this. Our 54-year-old male employees aren't able to do this. And so here's a raise because you have this special talent. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but I mean, I guess I'm just trying to think outside the box here a little bit, and which is what we try to do here sometimes on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And I should say once again that my guests are Lisa Senecal, the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Carrie Brown, the executive director there. We're talking about a range of issues relating not just to women but to men, but women. Women pick up a lot of the, you were talking about them picking up elder care, child care, and they pick up these issues because, that's what happens, I guess. Right. Anyway, let's talk about a couple of other things upcoming or actually in play already. Sexual harassment is an ongoing issue, and you were just mentioning it, Lisa, as being one of the barriers to women getting into higher salaried, traditionally male occupations, in particular because you show up at a male-dominated workplace, and ideally it's a good place to work, and there isn't a lot of sexual harassment going on, but certainly, probably there's more sexual harassment on average in a male-dominated workforce than in a female populated workforce. So let me ask you about what you see coming here. One thing is that the Human Rights Commission, Vermont Human Rights Commission, came out with their annual report in the last couple of weeks, and they had some legislative recommendations, one of them being that the state start stepping up with new laws relating to sexual harassment. There was an interesting response from Karen Tronsgaard Scott, with the Vermont Network Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. I hope I have that name right. Do I? Okay. Her remark was that we should start enforcing the laws we already have on the books. What do you think here? Are there gaps in the law relating to sexual harassment that could be filled in here in along the lines of what the Human Rights Commission is talking about?
Sure. I think there are still gaps in the law, but Vermont did pass a really effective sweeping sexual harassment law that went into effect in the middle of 2018. It has been lauded as one of the most comprehensive laws anywhere in the U.S. So we should be really proud of the work that Vermont's done to this point. But just because we've passed a law, it doesn't mean that magically all of the issues that were addressed in that law have been fixed. We have cultural issues and we have compliance issues. So there's a lot of work to be done before we see that the laws that have been passed have had the intended effect. One of my perennial concerns at this point is we still don't have a really effective way to help low-wage workers. And the laws apply equally to their employers, and they are intended to protect low-wage workers equally. But when you're in a job where it's difficult to take time off from work to be able to deal with the legal system, when it's difficult to be able to afford legal representation if you need it, it's a slow process. And very often when you're going through the process, your employers are aware of it. And being able to remain in that position, at least comfortably, is a very difficult thing to do. So we still don't have we don't have the system we need to be able to help those workers effectively.
So to say to your boss, "Hey, boss, I need some time off from work to go see my lawyer about my lawsuit against you for sexual harassment," that's sometimes a rather difficult conversation, I would imagine.
It creates some tension.
Yeah, it's not necessarily practical. And I think what the Human Rights Commission is looking at, a lot of the behaviors that fall into kind of a gray area or that aren't on the surface may not appear to other people as being situations of coercion or forcing somebody, or they talked about the idea of unwelcome behavior being perhaps needing to be better defined, or a hostile work environment needing to be better defined, or severe and pervasive. And I think that they're hitting on something which is really important, that a lot of people are facing problematic behavior in their workplace that doesn't necessarily rise to the level of breaking the law, but still makes it difficult or impossible to continue at work. And so one of the things that we have recently launched is this new campaign, including a website called Workplaces for All, which is designed to let people know more broadly about the protections that they do have under the law. And it also, so it includes information about reporting, very easy to access. The Human Rights Commission and the Attorney General's Office have one online portal that you can use if you want to file discrimination or harassment complaints. And we've got links to all that. But it also includes a lot of information about how to make a better work environment. Whether or not there is legal sexual harassment or discrimination happening, there's still a lot of problematic behavior that employers can take really concrete steps to try to prevent or to address when they see it. There are things that coworkers can do to support each other and things that people can do to make their own work environments better for themselves. So that's on this website, Workplaces for All, that has all of this really comprehensive information.
So if someone wants to Google that, might not want to do that at work, you know, wait till you get home. But if someone wants to do a Google search, just type in Workplaces for All?
Yeah, it's workplacesforall.vermont.gov.
Okay.
And that's the easiest way to find it, just workplacesforall.vermont.gov. It's a state resource, and it's very comprehensive.
And you folks just came out yesterday with an announcement saying this was getting a launch. You had a soft launch, I guess, last month sometime, is that right?
That's right. And we'll be doing an ongoing push to make sure that as many people as possible find out about this, both employees and employers. There, as Carrie was saying, there are really good resources on this website for employers. And beyond just creating a healthy work environment and helping to take care of their employees, it's in an employer's best interest to make sure that they have that healthy work environment because it's better for their bottom line. Companies that don't have discrimination issues going on inside their companies, they have less turnover. They have an easier time recruiting. They obviously have, they're spending less in legal fees dealing with discrimination suits. Productivity goes up. So, and you tend to retain a workforce that's going to continue to become more diverse. And the more diverse a workforce you have, the less discrimination issues tend to have.
Again, the solutions, we were talking about the problems being self-reinforcing. Some of the solutions can be self-reinforcing as
well.
So it's a matter of sort of turning a tide here, I would think. And it's very interesting. So one more time, workplacesforall.vermont.gov, right? And that's the website to go to. And it sounds like I haven't looked at it myself yet. I should have last night, but I was busy doing other stuff. And anyway, if the idea is that you could be in almost any role here, you could be the boss is like, is my workplace kind of getting out of hand with this stuff? I mean, you could go to this website and do some research to give you some ideas as to whether that's the case, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's important for not just employees or employers, but for managers to understand what their legal responsibilities are. They have specific legal responsibilities for reporting and addressing sexual harassment that's been reported to them.
Okay, so this is a homework assignment then for managers out there.
It's
pretty serious. You know, you want to know what your legal responsibilities are if you are a boss. And I'll tell you, I've been in different workplaces where I've seen kind of a vastly different approach to this stuff. Very early in my career, I worked at a little suburban newspaper bureau down in Massachusetts, and the boss had pinups hanging around on the walls, and it was a pretty weird thing for me. You would come in just out of college, and I was, I'd been kind of steeped in a lot of the work against sexism and pornography and all this kind of stuff, and you walk into this office and there's Miss March up on the wall, and I'm like, okay, here's a cultural change, anyway, that is just kind of one flavor. Obviously, there are other places you go where, I've had other experiences where I've kind of said, is this like too tightly regulated? Is he, does the manager get up too soon and say, hey, you better cut this out right now when somebody makes a slightly off color joke or something, I don't know. And that's the gray area we talk about, right? I mean, there's a huge range in there of behaviors.
There is a huge range, but generally people, either the people committing the act or on the receiving end of whatever the behavior is, when you're crossing that line, or a bystander knows when someone has crossed that line. And it's really not that difficult to not cross it.
Okay.
And treat everybody with dignity and respect who you work with.
I think in the law they talk about the reasonable person test.
Yes.
You know, would a reasonable person perceive this if they just sort of watched from, you know, a video or a film of what was happening in this interaction? Would they say, nah, that's out of hand? Or would they say, you know, it's not a big deal? I think that would be the one obvious question there. Also, and we talked about the role of bosses, and just before the bottom of the hour break, I wanted to mention, obviously, if you are a person who is feeling like this stuff's coming down on you, you know, you're the victim here, or you are the target of some kind of sexual harassment or something, resources there too, right?
Yeah, that's the place to go. That workplacesforall.vermont.gov. There's a quick link you can click to get some quick basic information about what you should do first. And then there's also very, very detailed information about how the process will go and what you should do. Yeah.
And if, I imagine there are some people who are in the middle who are kind of witnesses to a series of interactions in the workplace, and they're saying to themselves, I hope this isn't over the line, and I'm a little unsure, et cetera. So I gather that they can maybe do some research in this realm too.
There are great resources on this website for bystanders that will help you figure out whether or not what you're seeing crosses a line. It helps educate people in how do you approach somebody who you think is a target of sexual harassment and what to do with documentation of it. You know, don't email yourself on your company email if you are trying to document it. But, you know, offer to be there as a support.
All right. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors. And when we return, we will continue our conversation with Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown of the Vermont Commission on Women. We'll be back very shortly, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
My guests this morning on the Dave Graham Show, this whole first hour of the program, are Carrie Brown and Lisa Senecal. Carrie Brown is the executive director and Lisa Senecal the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women. And give us a little recap here, if you could, Carrie Brown. Describe the commission. What does it do? What is its annual budget? And what Yeah, we'll start.
Sure, sure. So we've been around since 1964, and you're right that we used to be the Governor's Commission on Women. Mm-hmm. And about 20 years ago, we were transformed into the Vermont Commission on Women.
So it was about time I caught up with this, right?
And yeah, you know, it's okay. You're not the only one. There's definitely still parts of state government forms that come across our desk that still refer to us as the Governor's Commission on Women. So that's all right.
Yeah.
And so it's a group of 16 commissioners. They're from all around the state. They're appointed by the governor, by the Speaker of the House, and by the Senate Committee on Committees. And so we've got some political diversity. We've got geographic diversity. We're striving for as much different kinds of diversity as we can to represent viewpoints and perspectives for women from all over the state. It's not all women who are on the commission. We have one man. We've had more men in the past. And so the commission is charged with education, research, public education around women, issues of concern to women. And as you were talking about a little bit at the beginning, these are not just issues that concern women, but everybody. And kind of the other way around, too, is it's challenging for us sometimes to find an issue that's not of concern to women, right? So name an issue. Does it affect women? Yes, it does.
Yeah.
So, but we tend to focus on issues around economic security, on health and safety, on civil and legal rights, public life and leadership and education. And so we have a whole list of priorities of things that we're kind of keeping an eye on and working on. And as you can tell, that covers just about all the ground there is, but that's where we try to focus.
I'm always a little surprised when I hear just the number of commissioners, because, you know, I think of other state commissioners, you know, the Public Utility Commission has three members, you know. Is 16, is how wieldy or unwieldy is that, would you say? You're the chair, Lisa, so can you keep all these cats herded?
I think we all self-herd It's a great group of folks. I think that the conversations, the discussions we have are rich and nuanced, and having that broad, and Vermont is a small state, but, you know, Chittenden County is not Bennington County, is not Franklin County, and making sure that we have representatives from all over the state is really important, because there are regional distinctions, and it's important that everybody has that voice in the room.
And I would suppose you would have actually instances of individual issues bubbling up from a discrete part of the state sometimes. You know, there's a particular problem of sexual harassment at certain employers, and pick the county, Windham County or something.
Right. And we see that a lot in, you know, with economic development issues, or mm-hmm. with, opiate use is occurring all over the state, but there are pockets of the state that are struggling with it more than others. So all of the issues that kind of, you know, come tumbling out of that problem are also obviously issues that are going to be hitting women.
One of the legal changes, I guess, that is being contemplated right now in the state of Vermont, I read about this in VT Digger the other day, Representative Selena Colburn of
Burlington
she's had a very interesting role in the legislature, I think, and she's still fairly new in her second, maybe third term or something. She's hasn't been around there a long time, but she's done some interesting stuff there. And she's kind of getting a name for herself as being, you know, someone who thinks outside the box a little bit or a lot. And she's going to be a guest actually on the program tomorrow to talk about this bill, but I'm going to get your thoughts on it as well. Decriminalizing sex work in Vermont. What do we make of this? This is an interesting idea.
Yeah, it's extremely interesting. One of the clarifications that I think is important to make is that it's specifically about prostitution mm-hmm. as that one form of sex work. And this is actually important because sex work is a broad term that covers a lot of things that are legal. For instance, certain kinds of pornography and like exotic dancing, that sort mm-hmm. of thing. Mm-hmm. Prostitution is not legal. And so this bill would repeal the law that says prostitution is illegal. It would maintain, though, that human trafficking, coercion, underage, prostitution, all those things would still be illegal.
And underage, what age do we have in mind? Is that the age of consent in Vermont, or is it?
I believe it's currently 18.
18.
Yeah.
Okay. Lisa, you wanted to add something?
No, I agree. It's interesting. It's certainly an issue that I feel like I have a lot more to learn about to fully understand the implications. Mm-hmm. I do want to make sure that we make the distinction between decriminalizing and legalizing, where what this bill, my understanding is it intends to do is, as Carrie said, remove the law from the books that criminalizes this form of sex work. But it doesn't mean, you know, setting up a regulated sex work entity that would be able to, you know, collect taxes and regulate the system.
Yeah, that was one thing that was, I think, made pretty clear in the VT Digger story that I saw about the this legislation being offered by Representative Colburn. And that is that it's more a matter of repealing a law that's on the books right now, which basically outlaws the sale of sex, I guess. That's the classic, you know, prostitution that people think of. And repeal that. And some of her reasoning I thought was fascinating and made sense. One of the issues that comes up that if you are in a world that is illegal, you are much more susceptible to different forms of violence and coercion and so on and so forth. What do you think? Does that make sense to you, Carrie, Ron?
It's really important to understand that prostitution is one of the most dangerous occupations that there is. So the threat of violence, of contracting disease, of exploitation, forced drug addiction, and death, it's really, really high. And part of that is linked to the fact that it's illegal. And so if you're working as a prostitute and you think you might have a sexually transmitted infection, you may not be as likely to go to the doctor and seek medical care. And you don't have recourse if you experience violence at work the same way that legitimate employees do. And so making it legal would potentially help to make it a bit safer. And that's a major motivation for proponents of legalizing it.
Why would you be less likely to go to seek a doctor's appointment if you thought you had an STD?
Because you may be afraid of revealing that what you're doing for work is illegal and making yourself vulnerable to the law that way.
Hmm. Boy, I don't know. I think, most doctors I've known would be just interested in delivering the needed health care and saying, doctors deal all the time with people who are engaging in, let's say, illicit drug use. I mean, using heroin in Vermont is illegal, but I don't know of any doctor that's going to be bringing some kind of calling the cops if you come in with a heroin addiction.
And I think that's absolutely true from the doctor's perspective, mm-hmm. but I think from somebody who is abusing drugs, prescription or non-prescription drugs, or is involved in what's currently illegal sex work, that feeling of confidence that you can trust people within the system, that they are not going to judge you harshly and somehow, report you and cause you harm. I mean, people are still concerned about going in and getting HIV tests because they're afraid mm-hmm. that information is going to be revealed. So people have a real fear about, and there's nothing illegal about having a positive HIV status.
Yeah. I guess there still is just so much stigma out there attached to a range of these issues that's a big part of the burden that any patient's going to be carrying when they show up in a healthcare setting. And it's unfortunate because, I do think that at times you want to kind of strip away the extraneous stuff and extraneous attitudes and concerns and all this and just focus on making sure that the person is getting the health care they need, whether it is a matter of illegal drug use or HIV status or the person is a sex worker. To me it's kind of like sometimes a lot of problems, the first approach is to kind of simplify them, and pull away some of these extraneous issues of stigma and so on. But I know it's hard. Obviously, that's why they still exist. I'm curious, though. 244-1777 is our call-in number here. And I want to know from listeners out there, if you are willing to tell us, what do you think? Should Vermont become the first state in the country to decriminalize prostitution, basically? Now, I understand that there are, and you mentioned, Lisa, this is this important distinction between decriminalizing and legalizing. And I'm thinking some of this language is sort of been refined in the world of cannabis because we've had this huge debate in Vermont in the last few years about, we first decriminalized cannabis back in 2013 or 14 or something like that, where possession became no longer a criminal offense, but actually it was a civil fine for a while in the state. It was sort of like a traffic ticket. At certain levels. I mean, obviously, if you have 50 pounds in your trunk, it's a different story. But small amounts of cannabis possession would be treated as a civil violation in Vermont for a few years there. Then July 1st of 2018, Vermont had a new law go into effect saying that it was legal to possess cannabis up to an ounce if you're over 21 years old, and you could also keep a few plants. I don't remember exactly off the top of my head, except that I know that if you have a green thumb, you'd end up with more cannabis than you could possess. Still a little wrinkle to work out in the law there. The issue here is sort of the distinction between legalization, which I guess we have this sort of still semi-legalization, but we don't have a retail. People talk about next going to some kind of a retail system, as in you can go into a shop, as in you can now in Massachusetts and California and some other states, Colorado. And so the analogous situation there in prostitution or in sex work is some counties in Nevada have, I'm told, a system where they actually have businesses. You're driving down the road and you see basically a brothel or whatever, and people can stop in there and have sex and pay for it, and it's all legit and legal and pretty tightly regulated, I guess. And so we're not talking about going there in Vermont. We're not talking about you won't have a situation where you're driving down, you know, Williston Road, and in between a couple of gas stations, there's a place to pull it and have sex, right?
Correct. We're definitely not talking about that. One of the things that my understanding is that decriminalization would address is that right now, if you're engaging in an illegal activity, you can lose your housing. Mm-hmm. And for a woman to become homeless because she is a sex worker, that's certainly not something that we want to see happening to women.
Right, right. And Carrie, you were going to add something.
Yeah, well, I think that we could be one of this bill would only repeal the law that makes prostitution illegal. And so mm-hmm. it doesn't really say anything about what happens after that. So I think we could have a situation where we have independent contractors who are be able to have a legitimate source of income. So they're paying taxes. Mm-hmm. So they're paying into Social Security. So when they apply for a child care subsidy, they have some income to show, that sort of thing,
yeah.
Legitimize it. Mm-hmm. But what it doesn't do is put into place some kind of a regulatory structure that would be, for instance, setting age limits on who can be a prostitute, or setting guidelines about how the industry is run that would increase safety. So, for instance, we have professional regulation of some other industries in order to ensure that there's safety for both the clients and the people who are doing the service.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't put something like that into place, but it does open up a conversation, I think, about would that be in the interest of the people who are actually doing this work. And we need to make sure that as we're discussing this, we have those voices in the room. And part of what's challenging is that we're talking about illegal activity right now. And so it's very hard to get people to show up and say, this is what I do for a living and here's what's in my interest. But still, that's we can't really make decisions without being able to have some of that perspective.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point there. I mean, it would be tough for anybody to come out now in the legislature in an organized sense, in a committee hearing or in a public hearing or something, and say, yes, I'm a sex worker, and here are the things that our industry needs, that kind of thing. In connection with paid sex work, you know, I'm going to give you a little bit of taste of my own bias here, which is that I remember when I first went to London, took the train in from Gatwick Airport into Victoria Station, and you come out of the train station there, and look around, and there are all these beautiful historic buildings, and wow, I'm in the British capital, and this is something going to be something, and yet the entire scene there is what I thought was really kind of cluttered up with billboards, you know. And I want to look at some historic buildings. I don't really care right now about what shaving cream I'm supposed to use, and I have this instinct in me that says, I respect capitalism, the profit motive, all of this stuff, marketing, the whole nine yards of that stuff. But is there any realm in life we can get to where we just say, it doesn't come in here. Money's not an issue, you know, and I don't know. I just, that's my struggle with the idea of paid sex work. It seems like people who are having sex ought to like each other, maybe love each other. It's something that it makes me a little uncomfortable. How do I get around that?
Well, as a parent, I'm completely with you that I want people who are having sex to be happy and willing and have it be about relationships. And I also recognize that people exchanging money for sex in various forms has happened since the beginning of time, right? That's why they call it the oldest profession, and it's going to keep on happening. And it happens in a lot of different forms that we currently think are okay, or at least legal. If you are an actor in a pornographic movie and you have sex, you get paid for it, you get a paycheck, and that's money for sex, but
yeah,
that
yeah.
one is okay. So we're talking about prostitution, which is for some reason is treated differently under the law. And I don't say for some reason like it shouldn't be, but there are real safety considerations that come into play here. But that recognizing that this is a part of our economy already, and so is this something that we want to recognize? Are we going to make it safer? We also have to consider whether legalizing it might make it unsafer in some way. So there's a lot of things to consider.
Yeah, I guess that you're right. It is called the world's oldest profession for a reason. We do have a couple callers on the line. Let's go quickly to Ted in Shelburne. What's going on, Ted?
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Back to the beginning, changing the subject. Just to bring to the organization of people looking for better treatment of women and all vulnerable people by those who don't treat them well, our society seems to be, as one pays attention to news and events, building, you could say building bad boys, but just not developing a healthy social, emotional environment or climate, if to use those two words in a slightly different way. And different societies are doing different things, but children are learning to be the way they are being. And I was just sad, and I don't know anything about it, but the suicide that was talked about in the Hardwick newspaper review of the week on DEV this morning. Working with developing social emotional development in children is, you can think of it as preventative in medicine or something. You're getting there before there's a problem, and therefore there isn't a problem. And in the case of an abusive person, it saves the abusive person the life that they are about to enter as they become abusive. And we're almost worshiping in society some of the very famous people you see who have been involved in a very foolish way with prostitution, with abusing other people. Anyhow, Roots of Empathy is something to look at, .org, rootsofempathy.org, and also to note that in the Danish school system, and I don't know so much about this, Roots of Empathy, I became aware of when Scudder Parker was running for governor. I tried to feed that a little bit into a politician's head. Mm-hmm. I've been trying ever since, pretty ineffectively.
Dave Graham Show here.
I'm waiting, right, and it started on Mark Johnson. I've have been aware of and spoken to and handed paper to many of our government leaders and candidates and so on.
Yep.
I think it would be something worth talking about. So I'm hoping...
The rootsofempathy.org.
I'm hoping the concept of working with children before there is trouble. And
yeah.
I would like to hear our governor candidates and so on have this enter into their debate as something they could do for us. Thanks very much.
Does this make sense to you, Lisa Senecal?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Ted, I'm really glad you brought this up. You have a lot of company in this area. There are a lot of conversations happening more and more all the time about healthy manhood and how it is that we raise healthy, empathetic boys who are taught and that we're teaching the culture that men and boys are allowed to have a full range of emotions and expression, and that things that are seen traditionally as female or male are things that we need to soften that line on a whole lot.
All right. Well, I think I let the time get away from us a little bit, unfortunately. I should have given you two the 2 hours instead of just 1 hour, but that's going to have to do it for this segment this morning. Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown of the Vermont Commission on Women, thanks so much for coming in. Let's do this more often.
Thank you.
We're going to go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News and a couple words from sponsors. Back with more of the Dave Graham Show shortly.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring. The aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air. The coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat. But we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back for the second hour of our program this morning, and I want to tell you a little bit about what's coming up. Our Seeds to Society segment is this program we've been doing every Thursday with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Second hour of the Thursday program. They've got a bunch of people up there very knowledgeable about individual fields within the overall field of food and agriculture, and they are very very good about lining up interesting guests for us every week and helping us come up with good topics and so on. And this week we're going to be talking about the perennial issue in Vermont of agriculture and water quality. We've got a couple of people from the UVM Extension Service who are going to be joining us in a few minutes to talk about those topics. Obviously, this has been in the news recently with the announcement by the Attorney General recently that T.J. Donovan said recently that his office is suing a large farm for violating state permit rules and so on. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, as well as we will be bringing in our guests from the UVM Extension Service, and I'm sure that'll be an interesting conversation. So if you have any a stake, I think we all do, a stake in clean water, certainly, a stake in agricultural practices in Vermont, keep your ears open, keep it tuned right here to WDEV FM and AM, and we'll be talking about those topics in a little bit. In the meantime, for the next 10 minutes or so, I wanted to open the phone lines and invite listeners to call in. I missed a couple calls in the first hour because we were so deep into the discussion here with my two guests, Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown of the Vermont Commission on Women, those folks providing some very interesting perspectives and thoughts about sexual harassment, about this idea that a legislator is... a few legislators now are backing the idea of decriminalizing prostitution in Vermont, and that's something which I sort of expect might be a tad controversial in some people's minds, and I'm curious to know what our listeners think about that. And the obviously the beat goes on in Washington, where the impeachment discussion. You know, this is a fascinating time now where House Speaker Nancy Pelosi seems to be still holding on to these articles of impeachment and saying she's going to be not sending them over right away, apparently, until she gets some kind of assurances from the Senate that the House impeachment articles will be at least, taken somewhat seriously. I think that's where the Speaker wants to go with this stuff. There's a lot of... sort of brushing the whole thing off in the Senate. Obviously, that's something that I think the Democrats feel as though, the House Democrats feel as though there needs to be a little more. They want to see witnesses called in the Senate. And, of course, the big news on that front this week was John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, announcing that he would be willing to say, to come in and testify in the Senate if they did call witnesses. He, of course, was working for the White House during the critical time last summer when there was this quid pro quo deal between or offer by the president of the United States, Donald Trump, to the president of Ukraine, that if you are willing to reopen an investigation into Hunter Biden and the son of Joe Biden and by extension Joe Biden, my potential political opponent, I will release this military aid we've been promising you, close to $400 million, and I will grant you a White House meeting. And meanwhile, there's another brawl about launching here. According to The Hill, the Trump and Democrats are squaring off on the issue of war powers. There's a lot of concern voiced in recent days by Democrats on both sides of Congress, the House and the Senate, that the... President may have stretched it just a bit when he unilaterally ordered the strike last week that killed the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Obviously, we've had a lot of fallout, literally and figuratively, since the attack of last week, and including Iran's response on this Tuesday evening our time, in which they fired missiles at U.S. bases in Iraq. Thankfully, no U.S. casualties. But so all of that stuff continues to roll along, shall we say, down in the nation's capital and elsewhere. But the focal point certainly is Washington. And we are happy to say we're talking with the Office of Senator Patrick Leahy about possibly getting the senator on our show early next week to talk about some of this stuff. He obviously has a role to play. He's a potential juror in an impeachment trial of the President of the United States. He may not want to tip his hand too much on that. I wouldn't if I'm a potential juror somewhere. So, but he also is very, very keen on trying to see whether the Congress needs to have a greater say in the War Powers Act. It used to be that the president needed to go to Congress actually to ask for a declaration of war. That last happened, of course, in the famous Day of Infamy speech by President Roosevelt at the beginning of World War II. And the United States seems to have drifted further from that over time. We are now at this point where the Congress is saying, hey, wait a minute, we ought to at least be told that the president is making a decision to attack a foreign power. That's really a rather striking, literally, figuratively, et cetera, I guess, pardon the pun, expression. But if the president is poised to launch a military attack, it seems as though somebody in Congress ought to at least be notified so that people in Congress can have a chance to maybe at some point raise a hand and say, we want to talk about this and talk about the course of whatever military action might follow. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, WDEV-FM and AM. And we enjoy taking in a range of political views on our show here. Looks like we have a caller on the line, one of our regulars, Rama. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, hey, I'm going to be real quick because I don't want to bother your listeners with having to hear what I have to say.
Oh, come on.
But actually, this goes back to Paul from Moncton there, and I've listened to him over the years. He's listened to me over the years. Mm-hmm. We have a lot in disagreement and some in common.
Yep.
But he made the comment that he was worried that what he heard me say yesterday about, that we could absorb more, being a bigger country.
More punishment.
Right. And that he thought what he heard was people getting hurt. And to tell you the truth, just to be quite blunt on this, I think that's a risk that we ought to be willing to accept. If you're going to be righteous and good, you accept the risk. And the problem is we have these politics that are so based on fear right now, so based on this fear that something bad is going to happen to you today,
mm-hmm.
that people can't make rational decisions. They're making these decisions based on this heightened sense of fear of what's going to happen as opposed to what they want to do, where they want to go. And I have vision. And this is how I lead my life. I have vision. I have principles. And I am willing to take risks, and I am willing to take sacrifices, and I am willing to take hits in order to stick with my principles and to move forward to a vision. And that's all I really want to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wasn't as put off by your remarks yesterday as our friend Paul was. I think that there's a lot of rhetoric around, especially around military confrontations and so on, that frankly I think if you really unpack it can be kind of bothersome. But not surprising that we would get into this sort of issue of semantics over what is this punishment. But I mean, I agree with it and actually admire your stance, Rama, that you're willing to take some hits for the stances that are important. And an important principle. So thanks for the call. The University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences approached us back in the summer, late summer, I think it was, and said, let's do a series of programs devoted to issues of food and agricultural production in the state of Vermont and elsewhere. We've actually had guests on. There was a gentleman on from India talking about preserving seeds and the variety of seeds a few weeks ago. So people from around the world actually have been our guests on this segment. I'm finding it fascinating myself. I don't have an agricultural background, but just lots of questions. And I go by the theory that the only stupid question is the one you forgot to ask. And because my sense of it too is, and this is a general policy or philosophy approach to the show here, is that a lot of the listeners out there. There's a range of knowledge out there in terms of what people know about different topics. I'm going to go with a fairly low common denominator, assuming that people are busy with their own lives and they're not expert in whatever my next guest is talking about. And so we're going to start with the basics and move into maybe move into wherever the curiosity takes us and wherever the listeners' calls take us. And certainly we love our listener calls at 244-1777. Anyway, the Seeds to Society segment this week is going to focus on agriculture and water quality. This is a topic which was highlighted just recently because the Attorney General of Vermont, T.J. Donovan, announced, I believe it was last week, that the state of Vermont was suing the state's largest dairy farm. This is a 5,000-cow operation. I once toured, about a 1,200-cow operation, which I was just amazed at what a gigantic mechanized situation they had on that farm. And this is, I guess, four times the size of that. And I'm like, wow, I didn't know there was a 5,000-cow farm in Vermont. But this is the Pleasant Valley Farm up in Berkshire, Franklin County. It's operated by Mark and Amanda St. Pierre. Amanda St. Pierre also is lobbies for the dairy industry in Vermont, and so a lot of folks know her in that capacity. But they, this seven-count complaint filed in civil court in Franklin County, the Attorney General's office. I'm relying on a report now from vtdigger.org. The Pleasant Valley Farms failed to acquire a large farm permit when it expanded in 2017 and had violated the state's agricultural regulations. And, of course, one of the concerns here, or maybe the biggest concern these days, is that if you don't follow the rules, the chances go up that you are doing things which will contribute pollutants to our rivers and lakes. And certainly people are very concerned about the Missisquoi River flowing into Lake Champlain up in that neighborhood of the state. And so there is significant concern there. And we want to talk about more generally, I think, about agriculture and water quality. And I've got just the guest to do that today via the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at UVM and our Seeds to Society segment. Joshua Faulkner is a PhD, a research assistant professor and farming and climate change program coordinator with UVM Extension's Center for Sustainable Agriculture. So, I believe he's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Joshua Faulkner.
Good morning, Dave.
Thanks for joining me. Kirsten Workman is an agronomy outreach professional with UVM Extension, and I believe Kirsten's on the line as well. Is that right, Kirsten?
I am. Thank you.
Thanks for joining the program. So I want to ask you, the two of you, water quality concerns are an increasing concern around Vermont. Both sides of the state, we have big bodies of water, the Lake Champlain, the Connecticut River. Agriculture is a major land use in the state, and it's estimated that farms contribute about 40% of the nutrients that affect our waters. And when you see a story like this, I'm going to start, I think, with you, Kirsten, this story about the farm up there in Berkshire. I would gather that's got to be sort of especially disturbing to someone in your line of work. Is that true?
Well, I'm not familiar with that particular case, mm-hmm. for sure. But, I think what it comes down to is really, the state does have these regulations in place. We now have what are called the required ag practices that came into law in 2016, which were sort of an uptick of what we used to call the accepted agricultural practices. And along with those, and even before then, were these permit requirements, which this case specifically refers to. And so the case, I don't think, is claiming there was like a discharge or a runoff event or anything like that, but more that the farm didn't follow the proper channels to acquire the permits they may have needed. And those permits, as you alluded to in your introduction, are really set up to kind of prevent situations from happening. And they really are focused, and what we're focused on in Vermont right now across the state is, you know, reducing and eliminating nutrient runoff to surface waters. And if you're basically on the west side of the mountains, you're looking primarily at phosphorus that eventually ends up in Lake Champlain. And there's what we have, what's called a total maximum daily load. That's the EPA regulations we're operating under. Mm-hmm. And if you're on the east side of the state, then you're more focused on nitrogen runoff to the Long Island Sound via the Connecticut River watershed.
Why is it that that phosphorus is the element of concern on the west side of the Greens and nitrogen is the element of concern on the east side of the Greens?
So that basically is dependent on the body of water it ends up in. So Lake Champlain is a freshwater environment, and mm-hmm. the limiting nutrient for algae blooms there is phosphorus. But when we get into the Long Island Sound, which is a marine environment, then the limiting nutrient for eutrophication becomes nitrogen.
I see. Wow, I didn't realize that it was that stark a difference between the two. I would think that is nitrogen a lot less of a concern in Lake Champlain?
It's not. I mean, they're basically very well related. It just chemically speaking, when you get into those surface water environments, that just it's the physical chemical reaction that's happening, that nitrogen is what's driving algae blooms and marine environments, and phosphorus is what does it. But they're so often they kind of go together. And so it's not that nitrogen isn't an issue for us here on the west side of the state, and it's not that phosphorus isn't a worry on the east side of the state. It's just that's what drives our EPA sort of restrictions. And so we focus on really kind of focusing on the practices that will kind of help those particular nutrients, because they are very different in how they behave.
Okay, so it's phosphorus is the canary in the coal mine on the west side of the state, and maybe nitrogen is the hermit thrush in the woodlot on the east side of the state, we'll call it, or something like. I mean, they sound like they are sort of signal elements in these regulatory matters more. Is that fair?
Sure.
Okay. Interesting. Now I wanted to bring in Josh here. Do you prefer Josh or Joshua, by the way?
Either one, Dave.
Okay. Joshua Faulkner, and your work there for the UVM Extension Center for Sustainable Agriculture, do you go out and actually meet with farmers and talk to them about techniques and how to go about the strategies for reducing runoff and so on?
Yep, sure do. Both Kirsten and I both do that. We work in a little bit different capacities. Kirsten, I think, focuses more on the practices within the field, and then my training as an soil and water engineer, I do a lot of work both around the barnyard, the production area, but then also helping farmers understand how water moves through their farm and what nutrients it might pick up as it travels across the land, and then we go from there in terms of what might be the best management practice to implement on the farm to better control those nutrients and curb runoff.
Give me a sense of the trend here. In the last 10 years, has this problem in Vermont gotten better by virtue of the work that you and others are doing to deal with it? Or has it gotten worse because it's just a bigger problem than the resources were thrown at it so far?
I'll say a couple of things. I'll say one is that Vermont has a really impressive record on the number of best management practices and changes on the farm that have occurred over the past several years. Of course, that takes time to observe that in the receiving waters. These are natural systems, and there's lag times within those systems, both in the landscape and within the receiving waters. And then the other, I think, complicating and confounding factor is that our climate is also changing a little bit, quite a bit over the past 10 to 15 to 20 years, with more extreme storms and wetter conditions that is making it more difficult to control the runoff and the nutrients on the landscape. So farmers are doing a tremendous amount, but there is a little bit of kind of having the deck stacked against them in terms of the natural environment and the changes we're seeing in precipitation patterns.
And then the other problem that farmers are facing, of course, we hear from time to time, is the economic squeeze of low milk prices and tough to make your revenues match your inputs and so on. How is that affecting farmers' ability to kind of get on this clean water train?
Well, it's kind of a two-sided, you know, thing. I mean, there is that limitation of when you don't have adequate cash flow, it's hard to make investments in your farm at any level. So whether it's on cow comfort or mechanization, if you're a vegetable producer looking to have better harvest economics. But then, you know, there's also the piece of that, like when money's tight, how do we be the most efficient with those resources as possible? And many times the conservation practices that we're working with farmers on are really just good farming practices. So yes, they reduce runoff, but they also might reduce your fertilizer bill or reduce the amount of fuel you use of traveling across your field. And so we're constantly trying to make that economic connection so that farmers can see the value in the potential return on investment in these practices. But it's kind of both. It's really hard to say put in a manure pit and spend money on that kind of thing if you have very little to negative cash flow. But maybe we can get you to do no-till because you're going to use a third of the fuel to get your corn crop planted. So it kind of can work both ways.
Yeah, and I suppose on the menu of approaches that you might be thinking about a farmer wanting to take or you folks wanting a farmer to take, that you're going to select differently from that menu depending on the size of the farm, the economic strength of the farm, and those kinds of factors, right?
Most definitely.
And so are do you, I was going to put the same question to you, Kirsten, in terms of the just the overall progress or lack thereof or whatever. This is one of those issues. I think if you follow the news about it, you know, the news coverage, as much as I appreciate news media and want to defend it in an age when it is constantly under attack, I do think sometimes that the news, the way it flows doesn't necessarily reflect the overall arc of history here, though. And so if you were to read all the clips in the Vermont media about agricultural and water pollution in the past, 5 years, let's say, you might think the problem was getting worse because maybe it's getting more attention. And so tell me, sort this out for us. Is the problem getting worse or are we really making progress with some of these efforts to do the required agricultural practices and so on?
We are 100% making progress. I think Joshua described the difficult situation we're up against very well. Part of that is that phosphorus in particular is a very long-lasting kind of legacy-type nutrient. And so while we could turn off the spigot of phosphorus running into our surface water today, we might not see the results of that in Lake Champlain for many, many years. And so that's really frustrating for folks who are dedicated to water quality. It's very frustrating to folks who are working on both ends of that, whether they're farmers or environmentalists or state agency folks in charge of kind of managing and regulating.
Yeah.
Sampling.
Well, we need to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news and a couple words from our sponsors. I want to continue our conversation with Joshua Faulkner and Kirsten Workman of UVM Extension on the other side. We will be back in a few minutes, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Wanted to mention our podcast before we get back to our main conversation here. The podcast, of course, is available if you go to WDEVradio.com. You can actually live stream anything we're doing on the air at the current moment, but you can, in addition to being able to live stream and see some other services, our weather reports and so on, it's an excellent website overall, folks, WDEVradio.com. One of the things that you like about it is that you can follow, there's a link from that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. You go there, scroll down a little bit, you'll find a list of our recent programs by guests and by topic, and you can say, boy, I want to go back and listen to that discussion about agriculture and water quality that they had on Thursday morning. I wasn't able to listen then because I was working or I had a dentist appointment or whatever. I understand people are busy this time of day, weekday mornings between 9 and 11 when we're live on the air here on the Dave Graham Show. The podcast, though, is the way to catch up, and you can do so any time of day or night on the internet, thanks to the internet, and also thanks to the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store for sponsoring our podcast. We really appreciate that. Alrighty, well, back to our conversation now with Kirsten Workman. She is an agronomy outreach professional with the UVM Extension. Joshua Faulkner is a research assistant professor and farming and climate change program coordinator with the UVM Extension Center for Sustainable Agriculture. And so that's really the nub, those last few words there in a long title are the nub, I think, of what we're talking about here, which is sustainable agriculture. And we were talking about both of these guests are telling us that we're making progress on this front, folks. Let's not be discouraged. It sounds like an awfully big problem, but Kirsten, let me go back to you for just a moment on this question of legacy phosphorus in Lake Champlain, because I have heard and read this elsewhere that even if we, as you say, turned off the spigot right now to phosphorus flowing into the lake, it would still be on the bottom of the lake for a long time, and it does have the potential to be released from the bottom of the lake into the general lake water and perhaps triggering more algae blooms. So it's going to be a tough problem to solve, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't get at it. I think, is that the bottom line here?
Exactly. And you know, farmers, I think, now recognize that. And so I don't think they're, you know, necessarily losing hope. They still know it's worth the effort to employ new practices and new technologies and new systems on their farms to really try and make a difference.
And I'm just curious, are you folks following any of the technological developments related to the lake itself and efforts to maybe extract phosphorus from the water and put it to other uses, or is there anything happening on that front?
I do not know.
Okay. I would gather that you've got plenty on your plate just trying to keep the phosphorus from going in there in the first place. We'll leave it to others to figure out how to clean it up once it's there. Is that right? Is that right? I wanted to also check in with you, Joshua Faulkner, in terms of I was noticing in the some of the materials I've been reading about the about your work, there are several projects in Addison County to evaluate the performance of agricultural best management practices. And so we were talking about this kind of a varied approach to different farms in their own individual situations a few minutes ago. And it sounds like there's almost an intentionality here, like let's try different experiments in different places and see what works. Is that right?
That's right. That's really exciting. Projects that are starting up this year and next summer, and one of those is to monitor a couple of small watersheds in Addison County that have quite a few farms within them. So we're talking, you know, 20,000 acre watersheds or so, and then see if we can evaluate how effective all these best management practices, the cover cropping and the no-till and some of the changes around the barnyard, are effective at reducing the amount of phosphorus that's leaving the landscape. And this is, I think, especially exciting for Vermont to have this type of work going on here. They've done this in some other parts of the country, but this is Vermont-specific data with Vermont-specific climate and our farming systems and our soils, and this will be going on for at least 10 years. So we're going to get that rare study in science where we get more than a 2 or 3 year look at what's happening. We're going to look over the long term.
It's going to be a 10-year project, you say?
At least 10 years. Yeah, we're working with federal USDA, NRCS, and state partners to ensure that this continues for quite a long time.
Wow. I would bet you that you know, if I'm the scientist in your shoes working on this, I'm really happy to think that there's that much support and patience, frankly, for us to come up with some solutions here, because, you know, these problems didn't develop overnight and they might not be solved overnight. But again, you know, we're turning the tide here.
That's right. Happy is an understatement.
Ecstatic, maybe? Is that a better word?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. All right. Well, the other, I mean, there are several things that we can delve into here a little bit, but one of the other issues or projects, I guess I would better word to describe what you're doing, is There's a wood chip bioreactor at the UVM Miller Research Farm. And tell us what that's about and what that's doing.
Yeah, that's an exciting project. That's a project that I'm leading with Dr. Stephanie Hurley here in Plant and Soil Sciences. And that is focused on one of the little-known runoff sources from farms, and that's from silage bunker runoff that occurs in the fall and the winter after farmers pack their corn or their haylage in for fermentation. And it can sometimes emit a really rich effluent that's very high concentration in nutrients. And so that's one of the barnyard practices. One of the things we do on farms is try to control that runoff from the silage bunkers. And this innovative practice at Miller Research Farm is using wood chips, actually, to harness natural processes, some degradation of those pollutants after we capture that silage bunker runoff. And it's a project that I think it kind of weds the Vermont ag industry and the Vermont forest products industry and utilizes some of the wood chips that our sawmills are making and puts them to use to help clean up some of this agricultural runoff.
Okay, so let me put this in real layperson's terms because those are the only ones I know. And is it fair to say you collect runoff from, say, a silage bunker, as you put it, rich in nutrients? You probably don't want that getting into the stream because we're trying to keep nutrients from reaching water bodies. And so you basically take it and kind of stir it into a bin of wood chips?
Sure. Well, a little bit. So very simply, as it runs off of the silage bunker, we let it pass through some metal screens to take out some of the silage particles because there's a lot of nutrients within those particles. So we just keep them from running off of the bunker for starters.
So you get a nice liquid kind of material, right?
So we just want to have a pure liquid.
Yep.
And then we send it through a series of septic tanks, if you will, and mm-hmm. and we allow any other solids to settle out of that, and then we aerate it. We pump air into it and within one of those septic tanks, and that helps transform some of the forms of nutrients, and then we direct it into a basin full of wood chips, where those wood chips provide the food for microbial organisms to eat the nutrients and transform those nutrients and release them into the air as nitrogen gas, which is inert and all around us.
Do they completely consume the wood chips, or is there? Do they just sort of? Does it look like moldy bread at the end of it, or something?
They use a little bit of the wood chips, but preliminary research on these types of systems indicate the wood chips will stick around for at least 20 years. So the microbes just eat just a little bit of the carbon in those wood chips in order to transform the nutrients at the same time.
Now, eventually, are you done with the wood chips, and then what becomes of them?
Well, we haven't had to take them out yet. They've just been in there 3 years, mm-hmm. But at the end of 15 to 20 years, when the wood chips have kind of lived their life in our treatment system, we would remove them and then mix them in with manure. This is something like a compost and apply it onto the field.
I see. Okay. They wouldn't raise beyond normal any risk of runoff or whatever there?
No, it would be applied according to a nutrient management plan, applied according to the agronomic needs of whatever crop that's growing within that field, just like farmers apply manure and compost on any farm.
So what have been the results so far of this wood chip bioreactor experiment? I mean, are we encouraged?
The first round of research indicated that we were removing about 50% of the nitrogen phosphorus from the runoff.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, we've made a number of enhancements that are expected to improve the performance of the removal, and we have a graduate student right now who's analyzing our latest round of data collection from this past summer and fall, and we don't have those final results, but hope to have them sometime this spring.
What, yeah, this, it's... this is actually I think fascinating stuff. I've been curious about these kinds of efforts. Are there any possible energy generation possibilities here? I mean, we think of anaerobic digesters. They're using those sometimes actually to generate electricity. Is any of that being talked about here?
Not with this particular treatment system. There are some that might generate methane, but we try to avoid any methane production within this system.
Got it. Okay. Got a couple callers lined up here. Let's go to Fred from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Hey, I'm wondering if a farmer's got a stream or a brook running through his pasture, is he required to protect that pasture with fencing from the grazing cows?
So not specifically. The RAPs are written so that stream banks need to be protected. Vegetation has to be left at a certain level, about 3 inches. So if there was a stream running through the pasture, you couldn't overgraze and let the cattle basically start to create erosion on those stream banks. At that point, you would be required to fence them out. If that stream ran through what they consider a production area or a heavy use area, then most definitely you would have to exclude livestock. But if you use good grazing management practices and you move them around and keep animals from going to the same place over and over and over again, and you don't overgraze, then there aren't those specific restrictions.
So the farmer would have to have a watering trough somewhere for the cows, right?
If they needed to fence the cattle out, then you would need to create an alternative water source. And there's a lot of good ways to do that through pumps. They have some that are powered by the cows themselves with their noses. They have solar-powered pumps. You can also create sort of a designated watering area. So that's sort of low-tech, where they can access that area and you protect it with, you know, good footing that will reduce erosion, and they enter the stream there to drink, but not the entire length of the stream.
So are the farmers required to help prevent erosion from a brook?
Say that question one more time.
In other words, during spring runoff, you're going to get a lot of erosion. Are the farmers going to be required to do some sort of management along the erosion side?
Yeah, so the RAPs are all designed, the required ag practices are all designed to reduce and eliminate erosion and those direct kinds of discharges. So you're required to manage your fields in a way that you wouldn't see that. And if there are sensitive times of the year, you wouldn't want to have animals, say, in those areas, punching up pastures, depositing manure. And that also would have things like in your crop fields, you're required to have buffers and keep stream banks intact.
So theoretically, that would keep the cows away from the brook.
During those times of the year, yeah, you would want to do that. Otherwise, you'd end up with the results that would be out of compliance with the state rules.
All righty, Fred, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Mark in Middlesex. Good morning, Mark.
Morning. excuse me. I tried to set up a deal with a value-added product to try to pull phosphorus out of some of these fields. There's quite a few farms going out, and these fields are, you know, former corn fields. Most of them are loaded with phosphorus. You know, excuse me. A lot of the time, it could be the runoff that's causing a problem. But what I understand from my reading is that there's quite a plume of phosphorus in the soil, the subsoil. So, my question is there money available? Or low interest, or grant money even, I guess, you know, we're trying to clean up this phosphorus situation, available for startups to get this ball rolling as far as getting this phosphorus out of the soil.
So the state did offer a grant opportunity that was sort of new and unique called the Phosphorus Innovation Challenge, where it was sort of that idea, like come up with a cool idea. They kind of funded a handful of folks proposals to do like the first stage, and then they narrowed it down after that first sort of little seed funding to narrow it down to the few projects that they really wanted to see move forward. I'm less familiar with that specifically, but there were a few projects funded in Vermont to sort of do exactly that. And I don't know the future of that, if they're going to do it again. It was sort of like the governor, sort of had this initiative to try and spur innovation in that way.
I have another idea. Excuse me. The plumes that are in the soils gravitating towards the rivers, streams, We'll find, you know, a low spot and kind of concentrate there. If shoring, you know, was driven right there, I mean, that would slow it down anyway, until you can figure out a way to, you know, and it would ball up there. You could probably even mine it, you know, set a clay bottom, drive your shoring. If it doesn't already have a clay bottom, a lot of these, you know, there's a lot of clay in the state. But anyway, just an idea.
Well, that's interesting. Thank you for that suggestion. Kirsten, that's actually fascinating to me because I have read and heard discussions repeatedly, really, about this this issue of legacy phosphorus in the bottom of Lake Champlain. And now we're talking about legacy phosphorus in former farm fields and what to do about that. So just another challenge on a long shopping list of challenges here. What would you say would be the top agenda item of 2020 in this field, Joshua Faulkner?
I think we need farms to focus on some of the practices that they've been doing, and we're going to focus more on outreach and education. We've been doing a lot of that within Extension, but we just need to get out there and contact some of those farms that you know, haven't received the information and try to get back into some of those back roads and make sure everybody's getting the education, resources and assistance that they can get.
Kirsten Workman, what do you think? What's the top agenda item in your mind for 2020 for this overall effort?
Yeah, so for me, I kind of bring it all back to, I call what's called conservation agronomy. So, you know, these conservation practices adopted as a system are key, and they really, really drive what we talk about as soil health, which includes water quality, but includes a lot of other things too, which is efficient, effective cropping systems, you know, good nutrient management, reducing erosion. And I think it's just keeping our eye on the basics. Erosion is still a primary source of nutrient runoff, and so we got to really focus on reducing erosion, building soil health, and making sustainable farming systems that are sustainable for our environment but are also sustainable for the farmers, and not lose sight of the fact that agriculture really can be our single biggest solution to this problem as much as it can be a contributor to the problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it comes both ways because that number I saw, 40%, I was surprised to see it's that high. I know that there are other contributors. Certainly, municipal wastewater systems are one. Another one is just the general runoff from streets and parking lots and rooftops, et cetera. People talk about those as being contributors of phosphorus and other pollutants into our water. You know, our streams and lakes and ultimately Lake Champlain or the Connecticut River on the east side of the state. And it makes sense. I mean, when you say agriculture is both the biggest contributor and also can be the biggest solution, it probably needs to be the biggest solution, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think farmers are up for the challenge. I work with an amazing group of producers called the Champlain Valley Farmer Coalition, that's made up of all different kinds and sizes of farms in Chittenden, Addison, and Rutland counties primarily. There's a group just like that, the Farmers Watershed Alliance, up in Franklin and Grand Isle counties, and there's a group now in the Connecticut River Valley called the Connecticut River Watershed Farmers Alliance. And these are farmers that are in. They're all in. They're doing these things. They're spreading the word. They're trying to talk to their neighbors and show how farming can be sort of an answer and a solution, and they can do it in a way that's viable not only for the watershed but also for the farm.
Do you find, I'll put this to either of you, whoever wants to take a swing at it, do you find that some farmers, you were talking about the farmers are in, are some farmers out? Are some farmers saying, you know, skeptical about the whole thing and, oh boy, here come these government people, they're here to help, quote unquote, and you know, we don't really need any more costs or regulations or this kind of thing. I mean, do you get much pushback like that?
Well, they're just like the rest of the population, right? You know, there's like the early adopters and innovators, and mm-hmm. then, you know, there's the folks that kind of come to it later, and there's folks that are resistant. That's true of any sort of initiative you look at in society. I think it's particularly difficult when you're talking about land managers and telling them how they should or shouldn't manage the land that's been in their family for generations, and someone like me shows up and says, hey, have you tried this? You know, and then, so that can be a challenge, but I think, you know, farmers also have a huge ethic for stewardship. and how they leave things for the next generation. And so that also can work in our favor when we have these difficult conversations. And that's why I think it's been key that they've taken such important leadership roles to show that no farmers are participating. They can lead a lot of these initiatives and really lead by example.
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly, you've got to kind of go in there, you know, speaking their language and also getting into finding out, what values do trigger a response and try to work with what's there, I would gather. That must be, it must be challenging, almost like, I don't know, a type of social work or something at times, isn't it?
Sometimes. And also, too, I think our role in Extension, Joshua and I, is to, like, try stuff out and figure out what doesn't work first so the farmer doesn't have to waste a bunch of money on something that we know ends up not doing any good or isn't good for the farm or doesn't improve water quality. And so that's where our research and sort of demonstration projects come in. It's like we can take that risk. We write grants. We try new projects. We come up with crazy ideas and find farmers that let us try them out. And then when we can kind of fine-tune what works, then we can, you know, say with certainty what may or may not be a good thing to do on the farm.
Have you had any experiences, either of you can answer this one, where you kind of go in? I mean, I'm thinking of these experiments down in Addison County, for instance, that we talked about a few minutes ago. Have there been any where you try something out and you go, nah, boy, that didn't work. Let's cross that off the list.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of times we do that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I think part of that is you try things that have worked in other parts of the country with different systems and different soils and say, hey, we're going to try this in a heavy clay soil in Addison County. It's not going to work. So, yeah, that happens fairly often.
Trial and error and, if you don't, what is it? If at first you don't succeed, right? So that is the, speaking of seeds, Seeds to Society is the overall title of the segment here. And on Thursdays, the second hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM and AM. Really grateful to the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont for helping us put this together. Really grateful to my guests today, Joshua Faulkner, a research assistant professor and with UVM Extension, Kirsten Workman, also with UVM Extension. Thank the two of you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Dave.
And we are fast approaching the top of the hour, which means I got to call it a day here on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. We're going to have Bill Sayre and his Common Sense Radio Show on. Tune in for our show tomorrow morning about 9:05 a.m., where we're going to be broadcasting live from the Vermont State House over in Montpelier, the first of our 2020 Friday morning visits for this session of the legislature. We'll talk to you all then tomorrow morning. Have a great afternoon in the meantime, and hasta la vista.